Heavenly King, comfort of the Spirit of Truth, present everywhere and filling all things, the treasury of good and giver of life, come and dwell in us and cleanse us from every impurity and save our souls, gracious one. Please be seated. Welcome again, and tonight it's a great pleasure to welcome Dr. Damandia Furlanos. The name, surname at least, may stick out with you because it wasn't long ago that Adamandia's husband Spiros, who's come and supported this evening as well, gave a talk off the same podium. Tonight, however, we're going to hear something interesting that's relevant for us in fasting. We all know, and I know as Adamandia makes a presentation as well, that the main purpose of fasting is spiritual, but there is a physical element as well. And a physical benefit. So she'll be focusing mostly on that and including the spiritual to some degree, but mostly focusing on the physical. And as you may know, it's basically what happens to your body. Why are you hungry? And what's happening to your body while you're fasting? Adamandia is a graduate of the University of Sydney. She's originally from Sydney. And one thing you may not be aware of, that Bishop Ezekiel actually baptized her. So that's something that Bishop Ezekiel is very proud of when he was in Sydney, that you're one of the thousands of people that he baptized in Sydney when he was there. And Adamandia completed her Bachelor of Science degree in 1991 and her PhD in the Department of Medicine up there in Sydney in 1996. Her doctorate studies centered around the relationship between muscle metabolism and the development of type 2 diabetes and obesity. Her research journey saw her work in Denver, Colorado, and then back to Sydney and finally to Melbourne in 2004. Her most recent research involved the hormonal responses to hunger following weight loss. Currently, Adamandia is an active member of her local Middle Park community where she lives with her family, and together with her husband and three daughters, is also a parishioner here of St. Eustathios Church. So you didn't have far to travel tonight, which is good. Welcome. Thank you very much for coming. And we've been looking forward to your presentation for quite a while. So thank you, Adamandia.
Father Chris, ladies and gentlemen, good evening, and it's a great pleasure to be here tonight to present this talk to you. Father Chris has been extremely kind in his introduction, and I'd like to actually begin this presentation by dedicating this talk to my late mother-in-law, Condilo Furlanos, who sadly passed away 17 days ago, and who, along with my family, husband and daughters, was also a parishioner at this church. I apologise in advance for any signs of nervousness because you will notice my signs of twitching. I haven't presented to an audience of this size in about 10 years. My previous career, as Father Chris mentioned, I was a medical research scientist, but most recently my role has been more significant than blessed, and that is as a wife and mother of our three beautiful daughters. Father Chris asked me to present my research as well as show examples in the scriptures of fasting. It's in my study of this topic in the last few weeks, I've learnt a lot about fasting in the biblical sense. In fact, in last Sunday's sermon here, Father Chris correctly pointed out that fasting occurs in the presence of abstinence of foods, but together with prayer. And alone, abstinence from food is merely just a diet of sorts. In modern times, in this era of abundance of food and its availability, it's difficult for some to comprehend the notion of fasting. However, while the current media emphasises obesity and its health-related issues, there are a significant number of people in the world for whom hunger and fasting are major issues. According to the World Food Programme, there are 805 million undernourished people in this world today, when this survey was done a few years back. Now, that's equivalent to the population of the USA, Canada, and Europe all combined. That means that 1 in 9 people don't get enough food to be healthy and lead an active life. Hunger and malnutrition are in fact the number one risk to health worldwide. It's greater than AIDS, malaria and tuberculosis combined. And nearly 600 million of those live in Asia and not Africa, as most people would have thought. On the other extreme of the scale, not to, please excuse the pun, but we know that lots of people carry excess amounts of body fat, and that when this reaches the point of obesity, health consequences are clear, most notably type 2 diabetes and cardiovascular disease. The World Health Organization, or WHO, estimated that 1.4 billion people or adults over the age of 20 are actually overweight, and 200 million of those, 200 million of that 1.4 billion of the adults, the 200 million men and nearly 300 million women are actually more than just overweight but obese. In other words, more than 10% of the world's population today is actually obese. Now, once considered a high-income country problem, the overweight and obesity issues are now on the rise in actually low- and middle-income countries, and particularly in the urban settings. Doctors and health professionals advocate for healthy choices, which include balance between processed and unprocessed foods, calorie intake to suit our exercise levels, plenty of fruit and vegetables, moderation in everything, and especially alcohol. This means that we need adequate intake of essential nutrients such as iron, calcium, iodine, etc. We must be reminded that Jesus said to his disciples, "My food is to do the will of him who sent me and to finish his work." In other words, integrating our daily food choices, our professional and personal lives, and our journey of faith will bring truth to the quote that we are what we eat. We should remember that our body and spirit aren't two separate entities. They're united as one whole. Therefore, spirituality, when you can understand the profound connections between your body and your spirit, it becomes natural for you to respond to spiritual experiences by doing something physical like fasting. Our body is an amazing gift from God. And as a medical researcher, the study of the physiology and the metabolism of the human body never ceases to amaze and humble me at the same time. This slide merely depicts a very concise summary of the body's overall metabolism. If I was to show you all the possible biochemical and physiological pathways that we study in order to better understand health and nutrition, we'd be here for many hours, and they would look like complex lines all crossing over each other with a not-so-obvious starting point and an even more not-so-obvious ending point. As my husband once said in a talk given here last year, to consider that a person is actually healthy throughout life is an amazing concept. There are so many complex connections within our body, and this is all due to God's grace. To think that God has provided us with an earthly body that apart from the simple task of breathing regularly, allows us to talk, hear, smell, walk, and endure both pleasure and pain, is a mind-blowing concept if you think deeply about it. Yes, most of the time our bodies function well, and we age appropriately throughout the course of our lives. However, as we know, illness can often strike our bodies, and medical intervention often is required. Spare a thought for a moment, please, for the multiple times that our own bodies actually hurt, whether it's a simple scratch, a common cold, a tummy ache, or lack of food, and then think about how little we think about how God has designed our bodies to actually heal itself through his grace. I often think about the complexity of the metabolic pathways within the body that regulate how the body generates energy to survive, and compare this to how someone may wonder about the stars in the universe and how overwhelming this can feel. The human body is truly a remarkable creation. Now to focus my talk on why I am hungry and what happens to my body when I fast. When we eat, the composition of food we've ingested contain nutrients that provide all the energy that we need for the metabolic processes and the physiological functions, muscular activity, heat production, growth and synthesis of new cells and tissues. This energy is released from food through oxidation. Most of the nutrients fall into three major categories. There's proteins and fats and sugars or carbohydrates. Some carbohydrates are simple and others are complex. This terminology refers to the energy that's required by the body to break down the sugars and can affect our sensation of hunger. In other words, the simple sugars are easier to metabolize, the complex ones require more energy. There are also different forms of dietary fats. There are saturated fats, or bad fats as they're often called. There's monounsaturated fats, and there's also polyunsaturated fats, often called omega-3 fats, and those are found in foods such as olive oil. This slide briefly describes some of the functions of each of the main dietary nutrients. The carbohydrates are the main source of energy for our body. And they also contribute many vitamins and minerals and dietary fiber. The fats are important as a secondary main source of energy overall, and they also boost our blood, skin, and vital organs. The proteins are the main building blocks of our body. They're important in building muscle and many cells within the body, as well as provide important amino acids that regulate important metabolic processes. Humans need energy for basal or basic metabolism, and that is a set of functions that are necessary for us to maintain our lives, such as breathing and circulating our blood and the maintenance of our body temperature. This amount of energy is called basal metabolic rate or resting metabolic rate, and it represents about 45 to 70% of our daily energy expenditure. This, of course, depends on a person's age, their gender, their body size, and their composition. Generally, though, a person with a large muscle mass will have a larger basal metabolic rate compared with a similarly aged person of a small muscle mass. The most variable determinant of metabolism is that due to physical activity, and this is the second largest user of energy in the body. Some of the physical activity is what we call sedentary, in other words, just the basic day-to-day things like, you know, waking up, grooming ourselves, maybe walking to work. But it also includes any exercise that we might do or something above what we normally would do in terms of activity level. In some people, often thin people, it's been noted that the amount of energy expended just in fidgeting alone, or what they call spontaneous activity, is significant and can change this figure from 30% to even higher. Our body also produces heat or energy through the burning or the thermic effect of food, which is the process of eating and digesting. The food ingestion generates heat production and utilizes oxygen consumption. And so over a single day, the metabolic response to food increases the basal metabolic rate by about 10%. Growth also requires energy for the synthesis of food. And while this is a significant component of energy requirement in infant children, the energy required for growth in adults falls to about 0%, and that's why it's not depicted on this graph. As I mentioned earlier, the two main forms of carbohydrates are sugars, such as fructose, glucose, and lactose, and starches or complex carbohydrates, which are found in foods such as starchy vegetables, grains, rice, breads, and cereals. The body takes in the sugars and then breaks it down into glucose, which is then absorbed into the bloodstream. Most of the glucose is taken up by the liver, and the rest of it goes into the muscle for storage as a fuel for when it's needed. When it's converted into a storage form of glucose, it's actually called glycogen. The way that this glucose enters both the liver and the muscle is through the action of a hormone that we call insulin, which is secreted by the pancreas. The lack of this insulin, or the lack of its proper function and work, is what causes diabetes. Now, the interaction of glucose and insulin in the body generally results in the normal regulation of the human body. The brain uses a great proportion of glucose, and it's its main fuel. Most of the sugars that are left over then are converted into glycogen and stay in the liver and the muscle for when it's needed. And so based on the size of our muscle mass, there's a limit to how much glycogen we can actually store for our normal daily activities. When we consume or eat too many carbohydrates, the extra glucose that our blood circulates has nowhere really to go. And so the body converts this form of energy into fat and stores it into its fat stores or depots for a time when it might be needed. And that's why it's important when watching how much you eat during periods of fasting in particular, that you don't actually eat more carbohydrates than you normally would, because you'll find yourself larger at the end of Lent, for example, than when you started. On a normal diet, we generally consume 10 to 30% of our calories as proteins and 40 to 60% of our calories as carbohydrates and 30% of our calories as fats, with an attempt to minimise the amount of fat as saturated to less than 10%. A typical 1.6 metre tall female of around 60 kilograms would require about 2,000 calories per day just for her basic functions. For a typical 1.9 metre tall male of around 70 kilograms, he would require roughly 2,700 calories per day. These energy requirements can change during one's life. There are greater demands on the body, for example, during pregnancy and lactation, as well as during prolonged illness. And obviously also if someone exercises intensely, then their requirements for calories to sustain their body weight is higher than these figures would show. The changes that occur in our body in response to fasting depend on the actual length of the continuous fast. Technically, the body enters into a fasting state 8 hours or so after the last meal, when the gut finishes absorption of nutrients from the food that we've eaten. In the normal state, body glucose, which is stored in the liver and the muscle as glycogen, is the body's main store of energy. And during a fast, this store of glucose is used up first to provide energy, and usually occurs within 1 to 2 days and is called glycogenolysis, or the breakdown of glycogen. So our glucose stores really only sustain us for approximately 1 to 2 days, either in the form of glucose or once it's broken down into glycogen. At this point, towards the end of the second day, the liver and the muscle has actually used up as much glycogen as it had, and the body then switches into another type of metabolism, mostly fat metabolism. Now, fat is by far our largest store of energy for the body, and this is why a person can actually survive without food for technically up to 70 days, if a person was a simple mathematical equation and an extrapolation. However, we're not, and without the intake of water, this length of time is dramatically reduced to somewhere between 1 week to 1 month, and would also result in significant health problems. Small quantities of glucose can also be manufactured through other mechanisms in the liver, and this is then called gluconeogenesis, another Greek word that just basically means the manufacture or the formation of glucose from fatty acids. Now, the breakdown of fat from our stores is controlled by the liver, which has the ability to convert fat into glucose, as well as ketone bodies for the production of energy in a state of prolonged fasting, or when caloric intake is drastically reduced, such as in extreme dieting. Only with a prolonged fast of many days to weeks does the body eventually turn to protein for energy. This is the technical description of what is commonly known as starvation, and it's clearly unhealthy. It involves protein being released from the breakdown of muscle into amino acids, which is why people who starve actually look emaciated and become very weak. During a fast, the modification in the availability of nutrients for energy is supported by changes within the body of many hormones also that normally regulate our appetite and our feelings of hunger and satiety or fullness. Some of these hormones influence hunger, while others regulate the feeling of satiety. My research was in this area. My research group investigated the effects of rapid weight loss on the regulation of these hormones. The hypothesis was that long-term weight loss is hard to sustain because our body has been designed to protect itself from the effects of fasting, and the goal is to maintain normal metabolism. That's why most people feel very hungry when they're dieting or consume less calories than their body needs. The body's response is to defend their body weight. It's part of our natural instinct to protect against famine. Body weight is centrally regulated at the level of the brain, with peripheral hormones that can influence the desire to eat being released from organs and tissues such as the gastrointestinal tract, the pancreas and adipose tissue. The hormones that are secreted by the gut system, the stomach, the adipose tissue, they send signals to the brain, and there a whole range of neurotransmitters then regulate the control of hunger and appetite. This area of the brain that does all this critical work is called the hypothalamus. It's an amazing area of the brain which integrates the level of so many neurotransmitters that I couldn't possibly list them all here, and which act to regulate this food intake and energy expenditure that we don't even notice that we're doing. The peripheral hormones can be divided into stimulators and inhibitors of hunger. So far, the only hormone that's been identified to stimulate hunger is called ghrelin, which is released from the stomach. For example, first thing in the morning, after an overnight sleep, our levels of ghrelin are very high. And once we start to eat, the level of ghrelin drops dramatically and then begins to rise again after another 6 to 8 hours of no eating. In contrast, there are many inhibitors of hunger, including cholecystokinin and glucagon, like peptide 1, peptide YY. All these come from the intestine. There's leptin, which comes from fat or adipose stores, and there's amylin, insulin, and pancreatic polypeptide, which come from the pancreas. All these hormones regulate or work in conjunction with each other to either stimulate or inhibit our hunger. Caloric restriction or dieting results in acute changes, which includes a reduction in the energy expenditure that we need to maintain our body weight, and also reduces levels of leptin and CCK, which inhibit hunger, and increase the levels of ghrelin, which stimulate hunger. Now, this is very hard to take all in this evening, but all these changes that occur are promoting weight regain. It's been shown in studies that when a group of people that were formerly obese come to a reduced obese state, either through dieting or other medical interventions like gastric banding, their daily energy expenditure, or the amount of energy that the body, or calories if you like, that the body needs to maintain its normal day-to-day functions, it does drop, obviously, as our body weight drops. However, if you compare it to a group of people who were never obese but who have now the same body weight as this first group that lost weight, the energy expenditure in the dieters or the reduced obese is much lower than would normally be seen for a group of people that never had a weight problem. What this means is that the body is in effect trying to shut itself down or protect itself from losing any more weight. So it defends its body weight or sets itself a new set point. And this is why it's very difficult for people to maintain a lower body weight when they've had to lose weight. Now, our studies have shown across the world and over many years that in fact more than 95% of people who actively lose weight will actually regain that weight back within 5 years, if not sooner. The successful weight reducers are typically those people that include a regular exercise program in their daily lives. They walk more often and they remain more active generally while also carefully monitoring their caloric intake. Now, while it may seem to you like I'm promoting a simple message of eat less and exercise more, the solution is generally quite simple. Yes, there are genetic reasons why some people gain weight, but in the majority of cases, we consume as a society more calories than we actually expend. The excess caloric intake is then stored as body weight, and in my experience, it's best to monitor one's weight to try and lose a few kilos when the scale shows the weight creeping up, than to allow oneself to gain many kilos and then try and lose them 5 to 10 years later. A new weight or set point is set, and the body tries very hard to defend the new body weight. In modern times, we are surrounded by excessive food portions, technological advances that make our daily activities easy, and so the challenge to maintain a healthy weight is not that easy. Now back to our research. What is not known, however, is whether changes in the level of appetite-suppressing hormones that occur during weight reduction are then sustained with prolonged maintenance of the reduced body weight. This was the focus of my work from my group here in Melbourne that resulted in a paper published in 2008 in the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition, and a later study that was published in the New England Journal of Medicine in 2011. Both of these articles reported on the effect of rapid weight loss on the circulating levels of hormones that regulate our hunger and our satiety, and they were conducted in order to better understand the physiological basis of weight regain after weight loss. In the first study, we examined 12 overweight males who were instructed to consume a very low-calorie diet for 8 weeks. This resulted in a body weight reduction of about 15%. Then they were instructed to follow a diet or to maintain that new body weight for about 1 week. At weeks 0, 8 and 9, subjects were examined in the overnight fasting state as well as for 4 hours following the consumption of a breakfast meal. This was so to study the postprandial or the effect of the meal on their hormonal changes. So these are the results. After 8 weeks on a very low-calorie diet, the body had received limited carbohydrates, and so fats were in effect being broken down to act as a major source of energy. Hence the top figure shows that there was a significant increase from the black line representing the baseline before the weight loss to this line, which represents what was happening after 8 weeks of weight loss. There was an increase in this called beta hydroxybutyrate, which is a ketone body, and it's an indicator that the body is actually breaking down fats and using them as energy. Once the person started eating in this hashed line for a week of normal food, these levels of beta-hydroxybutyrate actually dropped. And the reason they dropped was because as soon as that person started to eat a more typical meal that included more carbohydrates, the body switched back to using carbohydrates preferentially. The free fatty acid response, or the lipid oxidation to the meal, was similar after the weight loss, here in this lighter line, and during the ketotic state to that of the baseline. This indicates that there was a high degree of lipid breakdown, as I said earlier, occurring at weeks 8 compared to week 9. As weight loss results in an improvement in insulin sensitivity as well, or the sensitivity of the body to circulate insulin and deal with glucose, the reduced level of free fatty acids at week 9 reflect this happening. In other words, the body has been is more efficient at using glucose and requires and is more efficient at the inhibition, if you like, or stopping the body from using up any more or wasting any more fats. Down below, this is also another hormone that's released by the gut, and it shows that it's released by the gut to suppress satiety or to suppress our feeling of fullness. Following weight loss and in the absence of ketosis, there's a reduced CCK response and hence a reduced suppression of satiety. Following this test breakfast, what we did to the subjects is we then said to them once they were finished the 4 hours of study, you can go and have lunch now. But what we didn't tell them was that we measured what they ate for lunch and what was the composition, if you like, of the food that they ate. And what we found at the end of week 9 was the subjects on average chose meals with a higher caloric intake, supporting the fact that they had a lower CCK response. In other words, they were actually feeling a lot hungrier and they were less able to feel full because their hormone levels were lower. So this result down the bottom here also shows that in ketosis here, so this lighter line, when you think of certain diets that are in the media that promote high-protein diets, they're in effect trying to promote the state of ketosis. And what that is thought to do is make people feel less hungry and increase their sensation of fullness, which our data did support. This following slide also confirms our findings. The actual measurements of hunger and satiety are actually very difficult to measure because people's responses to those feelings, if you like, of hunger and fullness are very arbitrary and can change from week to week in how they view, if you like, or articulate how full or how hungry they are. So while we didn't have statistically significant differences, you'll see from comparing this black line, which is before the study started, to this line here where the people had lost their body weight, they actually felt less hungry through the course of that test breakfast meal. Another way to look at it is if you compare this dark line, which is the feeling of satiety or fullness throughout the meal, they felt quite full 60 minutes into after eating the meal and even more full after the reduced weight loss. Now, caloric restriction or reduced body weight results in lots of changes, including reductions in energy expenditure, as I showed before, and also levels of hormones like leptin and CCK, and increases in the hormone ghrelin and appetite, all of which promote weight regain. In our study, the second study that we published in the New England Journal of Medicine, we studied 50 overweight or obese patients without diabetes in a 10-week weight loss program using the same type of diet. So we, over 10 weeks, comparing lines A to the blue line, the black line to the blue line, in that 10 weeks the people lost on average 10% of their body weight. What we then did was we asked the subjects to keep eating less but more of a normal diet, to try and exercise a bit more but to try and keep their body weight at the new lower level. And we monitored them for another 52 weeks, taking it out to 62 weeks of study. So we watched what happens to their body in terms of their hormonal responses over a period of 1 year of weight maintenance. Some people did regain some weight, but on average, most people kept most of the weight off. We examined the circulating levels of many different hormones, and generally, insulin sensitivity, for example, was improved, and other hormones that would inhibit hunger were also improved. One thing to remember, though, with all these results of all these different hormones is that the physiological responses of the weight loss and then the maintenance of the weight did indicate that the body was able to maintain the reduced body weight, but that it was actually contrary to what would normally happen. In other words, the body physically or physiologically wanted to regain the weight. This last scientific research slide, if you like, shows the perceived rating of hunger and the desire to eat in this study. The black line, as I said, is the baseline before the subjects lost any weight, compared to, say, the blue or the red line, which is when they were in their lower body weight. And as you can see, during the testing of a breakfast meal, the subjects, once they had a lower body weight, indicated that they were more hungry. So the desire to eat, therefore, was also greater. In other words, the hormone levels in their body following weight loss did give them feelings of greater hunger and greater desire to eat. So these results highlight the strong impulses that we experience following weight loss that tries to promote weight regain, and which is most likely the result of many hormone and neurological interactions occurring within our bodies. And after seeing these results, you can clearly see why it's difficult to simply instruct a patient to eat less in order to lose weight. It's not such a simple solution, although self-discipline is a very powerful tool. Hence, fasting and continual prayer can not only improve our spiritual being, but can assist us to self-manage our body weight regulation too. In speaking with Father Chris over the last few weeks in preparation for tonight's talk, he mentioned to me many examples in the scriptures of saintly persons who showed extreme discipline in states of prolonged fasting. There are many benefits to fasting in addition to becoming closer to God through self-awareness of your body's needs and prayer. The physiological benefits include detoxification that occurs in the colon, liver, kidney, lungs, lymph glands, and skin to eliminate or neutralize toxins within our body. This process speeds up during fasting as the body breaks down fats. At a physical level, energy and resources are diverted from the digestive system, which is constantly in overuse as we graze on food, to the immune system and metabolic processes, allowing the body to heal, rebuild, and replenish itself. Medical studies show that during a fast, abnormal tissue growth, such as tumours, can become starved for nutrients and are hence more susceptible to being broken down and removed from the body. Fasting allows the body to tap its resources to their fullest potential and focus on rebuilding from a microscopic level to transcribing proteins and tissues and cells. The revamped protein synthesis results in overall healthier cells, tissues, and organs. What we consider fasting in the modern era should incorporate foods that will help release energy slowly during the long hours of fasting, such as complex carbohydrates found in grains, seeds, fiber-rich foods such as bran, cereals, whole wheat, some vegetables, and almost all fruit, including apricots, prunes, and figs. Foods to avoid are the heavily processed, fast-burning, high GI foods that contain simple sugars in the form of white sugar, white rice, white flour, as well as too many fatty foods. So in summary, Greeks and other cultures have a long history of fasting, although the reasons we do it have drastically changed over time. Fasting has been used for health and spirituality. The ancient Greeks abstained from all food and drank only water. It's well recognized that Pythagoras starved for 40 days to increase his mental perception and his creativity. In fact, today's scientists have proven this to actually be true. It was Hippocrates, the father of modern medicine, who created the Mediterranean diet that some of you might be aware of. He took fasting and food out of the realm of philosophy at the time and made them into a medical must. Fasting is also mentioned many times in the Bible, as we know, and discusses several 40-day fasts, including those of Moses and Elijah and that of Jesus. Loss of appetite is a natural reaction to times of distress, grief, and mourning, and fasting was considered appropriate at these times. David fasted as a sign of grief when Abner was murdered, and there was a 7-day fast at the death of Saul. Fasting is also a self-sacrifice that makes one humble and more accepting of God's will. Moses fasted for 40 days prior to his receiving the Ten Commandments from God. And Daniel fasted for 3 weeks before receiving his vision. Elijah fasted 40 days before speaking with God, and Jesus fasted for 40 days in preparation for his temptation by the devil. This is my final slide. It depicts Saint Eusebius the Hermit, who was a 4th century monk solitary of Syria, who undertook a vigorous ascetic life, living without shelter near a mountain village named Asika in modern-day Turkey. According to Eastern Christian sources, though he was elderly and weak, he ate only 15 figs during the great 40-day fast. Apart from his devotion to God that he would have disciplined himself to show and which nourished his soul, the significance of his food choice shows a selection of a rich source of fibre to sustain his metabolic, physiological and physical state during the 40 days. That and, of course, God's miracle of sustaining his life in his significantly weakened state. So I hope that I have enlightened you a little on the concept of fasting, both from a physiological and spiritual perspective. And to prove to you that Father Chris always speaks the truth, that is my christening, and that is His Eminence. Thank you.
Good evening.
Hi.
My question is on the stomach. We know that the stomach stretches by overeating. Can the opposite happen during times of, say, starvation or fasting?
I didn't hear the first part.
My question is on the stomach, whether it actually shrinks in size through a period of starvation or fasting.
Whether what shrinks?
The stomach.
The stomach. That's a good question. Does it? I don't think it does. Theoretically, but the stomach's not a very big organ. The intestine is a very big organ, but the actual stomach component is not that big. One of the ways doctors can help people lose weight is by making the stomach smaller. But what that does is actually doesn't allow as much food to get in. It makes it more difficult for the food to get in, so you therefore eat less because you don't feel as good trying to get food into the stomach. I don't think that the stomach actually shrinks. What does shrink during periods of fasting or starvation, I know from studies we've done, is other organs like the liver, for example, will actually become much smaller because it's just, while it's breaking down fats, it's not storing as much glycogen anymore. So, and the fat tissues obviously will also decrease in size. What happens there is that the fat cells themselves actually shrink. So when you lose weight, you're not actually losing fat cells, you're shrinking them. And so that's why we get larger and smaller, is because they're like balloons. They blow up when they're full and they shrink a little bit when they're smaller. But I'm really not sure whether the stomach significantly changes.
Okay. I've got one more question.
Mm-hmm.
You mentioned the ancient fast and you mentioned starvation and fasting. Now, with all those ancients, Were they always starving, or were they actually fasting from fat foods or whatever?
Or were they what?
Were they fasting from all foods, like starving completely?
Generally, in historical times, there are lots of mentions both with the ancient Greeks and Egyptians, for example. They often starved completely from food but drank only water. Other cultures, for example, might eliminate certain foods and eat some foods. But generally in the way back, the references are that they starved from all foods.
Okay, without any adverse effects, obviously.
Well, there was no doctor there to monitor them. But okay. When people did these dramatic fasts, they didn't just decide one day to do them. I think they took lots of practice runs, if you like. It was a form of discipline. It was considered a form of discipline back then, a devotion to either philosophy in terms of the ancient Greeks or, from a Christian perspective, devotion to God. So it was a way of allowing the spiritual part of a person to become more disciplined or closer to God, if in our case. So, you take little steps in order to get to the final major fast, yes.
Okay, great. Thank you for that.
That's right. Hi.
Hello.
Hippocrates, what was his name, the ancient guy?
Hippocrates,
yeah.
Yes.
So he fasted and that increased his mental awareness.
That was Pythagoras.
Pythagoras,
yes.
Whatever. All right, Pythagoras. So he starved for 40 days to increase mental perception and creativity.
Yes.
So I've got a pretty yo-yo diet. I try to eat well more than I don't. Now, during the fast, I've noticed that I mustn't be eating too well. My eyes are darker. I'm feeling very tired. I feel like spiritually I feel better, but my body feels exhausted. So I'm finding it interesting that his mental perception and creativity was alerted so much. Can you elaborate a little bit on that?
Well, I haven't looked into it in too much detail, but you must remember that back then they didn't do much.
Mm.
They philosophized a lot of the day, but they didn't really go far. And they didn't really do much, whereas you're obviously maintaining either university life or your working career, home duties, etc. So it's very difficult to compare both eras. In terms of mental perception and creativity, I think what they're trying to refer to is that they had the ability to avoid thinking about excessive other things that would, we would consider mundane things that we do day to day. So it's more rather than, being brightly and alert, it's more that they were more focused and able to just progress one way. If you're eating all the right foods and you've got all the nutrients that you need, there's no reason for you really to feel more tired. It's more that your body is slowing itself down to protect itself. A brisk walk, for example, is a way of stimulating the body. And that's the sort of thing I think that they're referring to, is that they were able to just switch on
and focus.
A good sensation. Mm.
Thank you.
That's all right.
Just wondering whether you could comment on the traditional orthodox fast and how that's different in terms of carbohydrate and protein. Just the audience might be interested in the implications of that are.
A typical orthodox fast, I guess, if you remove meat primarily from the diet, let's say, you're removing a lot of your source of protein and fibre. You're actually removing quite a bit of saturated fat, which is a good thing. If you remove dairy, you're removing some fats, again, some saturated fats. Calcium, other nutrients that are also important. But what you're doing is replacing them with hopefully more complex carbohydrates such as legumes, cereals, brown rice, brown wheat products. So there are ways of protecting your diet, if you like, to ensure that what proteins you're or protein intake you're missing, you're going to compensate for in other meal, in other food choices. Mm. Is that what you're referring to?
Yeah. I mean, the interesting thing is that the brain only uses glucose as a fuel, and it's distinct to all other organs. So I think with an orthodox fast, you're still having carbs. You're having less protein, let's say, if you don't have red meat. So therefore, you still have a good supply of glucose to your brain. So getting back to your question about mental perception, I think as long as you're having a fast where you have carbohydrate, which gets created into glucose, then your brain is fine. Mm. But if you had a fast which had no carb, then you have to rely on other processes to produce glucose to supply your brain. So, I mean, I don't think we really understand what the differences are in the different types of fasts and what effects they have on your mental perception. I don't think it's extremely well studied.
Mm. It's important to focus on the complex carbohydrates because they're released, release energy a lot slower over a longer period of time. So your body feels the sensation of fullness for a longer period of time. And it also is easier on the body to break them down, to digest and move those sugars into the muscle and into the brain. Whereas when you eat, say, a piece of white bread, I know from experience, 5 minutes later, you're starving because it just went straight through the system and it didn't have time to be digested carefully and over, you know, a longer period of time.
Mm. I just want to make another comment as well. If you go back to that slide of the gut and the brain communicating, and that question about, that one there, and that question about the stomach size. If you look here on the right-hand panel, there's mechano and chemoreception. So the stomach's got mechanoreceptors, so it detects stretching, and that stretching sends a signal to the brain. So when we talk about shrinking of stomach, it's not necessarily that the stomach actually becomes physically a smaller organ, but potentially you're changing the way the mechanoreceptors in the stomach wall sense stretching. So, I don't think this is very well understood, but potentially if you're constantly overeating, you're possibly desensitizing the stretch receptors in the stomach, so then you're not getting that signal to your brain saying, I'm full, because you're constantly stretching your stomach. But if you're allowing your stomach to actually involute by keeping it empty for periods and then you stretch it when you eat, then that reflex is intact. So I think that's where it's important. I mean, it's not a very well understood area, but I mean, we tend to think of it as, you know, shrinkage of the stomach, you know, as lay people, that's the sort of term we use, but I think it's probably got to do with the mechanoreceptors.
If three people of different age groups were to approach you and ask advice, one, say, child of 6 or 7, an adult of, say, 35, and an elderly person, say, 75, and as an Orthodox person, say, how should I fast? So a child, a 6-year-old, a 35, and a, say, a 70-year-old. What would your advice be?
The older person, most likely, would have a greater fat mass to start with. So they have enough energy stores in their body to be protected and to have enough fuel, if you like, for the long haul. The young child is in an active growth phase, and so their requirements or calories are actually greater. And protein is therefore a more important nutrient of choice there. So they'd have to look for foods that are higher in protein. Off the top of my head, I have to admit, I'm not sure what they are because I'm not a nutritionist. Fish. We can't eat fish some days. Some shellfish would probably have some high protein. The 35-year-old, let's say, person, again, depends on their caloric needs. You could have quite a high diet of polyunsaturated fats, which we find in walnuts, almonds, macadamias, and certain legumes. And these fats are actually extremely good building blocks for the body. Our fats are used a lot in the nervous system and also in our lipid membranes, which surround a lot of our organs and cells and things. So if you consume a diet with lots of polyunsaturated fats, you actually make your cells able to work better. It's like considering the surrounding of a cell a layer of foam. If there's quite a bit of flexibility in it and some good holes, then you can get things through quicker. And that's what polyunsaturated fats do. When you consume saturated fats, the saturated fats are the molecules are much more tightly constrained, and so you don't have the flexibility in getting important things in and out of cells to regulate your body. And that's why the saturated fats are bad for you, because they actually stop many parts of your body from working well. And so polyunsaturated fats is why people ask you to make healthier choices, because they really do make a huge difference. Also, the brain uses polyunsaturated fats for a lot of its functions, and a healthy brain is a healthy person.
Hi, I'm back again.
It's all right.
I was just going to mention, you said before that fasting affects us spiritually as well. And the key question is here, is the ego. Can fasting reduce our ego?
Depends if you're fasting for the right reasons. If you're fasting to lose weight, then I don't think it's going to help your ego, because you could be disappointed at the end of 40 days. If you're fasting with the right spiritual intention, then I think you dissipate that ego and become a bit more humble and a bit more simple in your your desires, if you like, of things that surround us day to day. Fasting is a form of quietening down a bit. It's not all about the food. It's about just eliminating aspects of our lives that take away our focus from God. So I think fasting should keep that ego in better check than it normally is, I'd say.
Okay, thanks for that.
Thanks for your talk.
It's okay.
When you go to the supermarket and you see those lean cuisines or whatever the heck they're called, the portions are like minuscule. Mm. So I need two or three to be full. Like, are you telling me that that's the real portion for an individual? It's tiny. Because I'm sure that I'm overeating.
I was actually anticipating that question today, because it never ceases to amaze me either what's considered a serving size. A serving size of vegetable, for example, is half a cup. So if you think of a potato, and we all love our potatoes, when you eat a potato, it's often a cup, which is twice the serving size. So yes, you can lose track of how many calories you're taking, because we're not trained well enough to understand how much we're consuming, because the media and the packaging has retrained us in the wrong way. When I was working in Denver, one of the colleagues I was working with, she did a lot of studies in children. And what she taught me was that by the age of about 6 or 7, children lose the ability to feel disinhibited. What that means is, if you give a child of that age a selection of foods and say, eat, they will eat until they're full. There's no question of what the caloric intake is. If, for example, in the day before, for whatever reason, they didn't eat as much, and you brought them back into the lab and said the next day, eat from whatever is here, take what you want, they will make up the calories that they were missing from yesterday. So they always stay in a state of equilibrium. An adult, though, loses that ability to dictate what they eat. So you might think that lean cuisine is small. It's in fact correct, but we're not trained to eat that way anymore. And the reason we get away with it usually is because we are quite, we are more active than sometimes you realise just by walking to work or taking stairs and things like that. But if you stayed in bed all day and ate two lean cuisines, you'd actually gain weight. So yes, our portion sizes are actually quite a lot less than what you think they are.
So tell me, doctor, for breakfast, okay, so for dinner, we know that's the portion, it's that tiny lean cuisine. For breakfast?
Again, if you want to sustain a full day of feeling full, you can't go past Weet-Bix, high brand.
Just two or one?
Well, I don't like Weet-Bix at all, so I don't use them. But two. I think two is a serving size. But if you compare a serving size of, say, Weet-Bix to a serving size of cornflakes, you're going to be starving with the cornflakes, but you might get away with the Weet-Bix till at least, morning tea time. Yeah, it's really hard because, you're surrounded by food and messages about food all the time.
What about lunch? Tell us about lunch.
Well, lunch is a good sandwich with slice of meat and salad.
Whole grain.
Whole grain's better than wholemeal, which is much better than white.
So just whole grain with salad?
Yes, it doesn't taste as good as having it with butter and ham, but if we are going to be strict about maintaining body weight or very lean body weights, it is a very disciplined field. It's really hard to instruct the population to eat less. It's not that simple.
But then isn't fruit snacking then?
Pardon?
Isn't eating fruit then snacking between meals?
Look, there's nothing wrong with snacking as long as, again, overall for the day, what you consume is what you need to burn, okay? In fact, snacking is good because it allows the body all these hormones. If you don't snack and you just eat, say, two meals a day, some people eat breakfast and then an early dinner. If you like, I'm just simplifying it now, but your body sort of does these extreme ups and downs of hormones. If you snack, you're sort of doing this, and so you're putting your body under a lot less stress, and so it's actually not a bad thing to snack.
Well, you know what, doctor, you did help me because, when you said half a cup of vegetables, you helped me because sometimes I'm cutting the broccoli and I'm thinking, well, how much do I need to get the nutrients so my brain can work? Do you know what I mean? I'm thinking, I don't want to.
That's exactly right. You just got to think positively. Half a cup of broccoli is sufficient.
And then just say we're eating chicken. Well, how much chicken are we talking?
Again, it depends. If it's the breast chicken, there's not much fat in there because that's part of the muscle of the chicken. That's quite good. But if it's red chicken, red meat, the red part of the chicken, then it's a bit more fatty. So you need less of that. So. Look, generally, the fatty foods, they taste significantly better, and you can't beat that. That's why putting butter on something is much better than putting low-fat margarine. But it's all in moderation. You just got to be careful overall.
Hi, my name's Helen. I really like what you said. When you put food in front of a child, they'll eat till they're full. They don't generally overeat. I think we've all lost that as we get older due to advertising and saying this is good food, good, bad food, and sort of put a moral value on food, whereas if we treat it neutral, then basically you can eat what you want if you want. Basically, that's what I've found is the best approach.
It is true. I mean, a lot of our food choices are habitual.
Yeah, because if you think, oh, that chocolate cake's bad, I can't eat it, I shouldn't eat it, then you're going to feel guilty and eat more afterwards.
There are a lot of aspects to eating. It's not as simple as just what we consume and what the hormones are doing. There's a whole psychological basis and field around eating. But yes, certain food choices we can educate ourselves to make, but it's not often that simple. Feelings of, for example, unhappiness can trigger sensations in the brain or trigger some of those neurotransmitters that work against the feeling of fullness. So you can feel hungry, for example. A lot of these neurotransmitters work across different pathways. In fact, we were having this discussion yesterday at lunch with my brother-in-law. You know, my sister-in-law was saying, you know, I've heard that if you drink Diet Coke, for example, diet drinks, you can feel hungry. And it's because there's a component in the diet drinks called phenylalanine, which actually stimulates a pleasure receptor in the brain. And so it's not the Diet Coke, if you like, that's causing you to gain the weight. It's that feeling that you get from it that makes you want to eat something else to go with it. So that's why it's not a very simple scenario, but it's important to try and remain disciplined and remain focused. And I guess if you start with children, is to always give them good, healthy options so that they, as adults, can learn the basics and then not fall into the traps of seeing, you know, an all-you-can-eat buffet as good value, because it might be for your wallet but not for your health.
That's right. Yeah. Also, I was just wondering with Pythagoras, how you said he had mental clarity. I don't know about you guys, but I find I don't get that with our fast, because we still...
You don't get what?
That mental clarity, because I think because we're eating constantly, we don't fast. So I'm wondering whether he really was like in a state of ketosis.
Possibly,
which
yeah.
Makes you more clear.
Okay. The lady that said about the portion food, it's also what they put in it to make us eat even more. So obviously, because if it's a portion food, you'll eat a bit of it, and then the senses in your brain will say, well, this stuff is pretty good. So you start going to the second one and the third one and the fourth one until you're full. And also keep in mind, it's, you know, you're liking it, but also you're spending the money to buy even more. So the company never goes broke. Mm. So at the end of the day, it doesn't matter what food you eat. Your brain will always still want more.
A lot of processed food contains extra amounts of salt.
Yeah.
The salt makes you feel thirsty. As adults, we confuse the feeling of hunger with thirst. So if you go home and test yourself over the next few days, when you think you're hungry, if you drink two glasses of water, that feeling of hunger will go away. So the foods we eat that have high content of salt, as you said, are to make you eat more of it, and therefore, as a commercial product, buy more of it. So yes, hunger is associated with other components in the food, which is mainly salt and other additives.
And also, it doesn't really matter if you know what size you are. If you're 50 kilos or 150 kilos. The brain just keeps saying that it's hungry. Doesn't matter if it's 1 hour or if it's 5 hours. So it's, I think what they put in the food, we have to be very careful of. But we, as human beings, don't think like that.
No, everyone is completely different to another individual.
Yeah. It's male or female.
Absolutely, yeah. At different stages of their lives as well.
And age groups.
Yes.
Thank you very much.
That's all right.
Through the prayers of our holy fathers, Lord Jesus Christ, our God, have mercy on us and save us. Amen.